also the old rule of test your backups, right, which very few companies do. We don't say this to try and generate services revenue or anything like that. We say it because it's critically important. That's a key tip.
Yeah, there's the quote, amateurs backup, professionals restore, right?
Yeah.
That's another one. I read that in a book. That's not mine, but...
very good. No, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, professionals restore. That's fantastic. You should tweet that. You should get some of that knowledge out there.
Maybe. I think it's been used a bit, but... Hey, yeah, there's one thing also that I wanted to touch base on. With conferences that are coming for the rest of this year and obviously for next year, I have some words of encouragement for people who want to become architects. Look at the conferences. Look at the areas where there is focus around design. And many times they're directly product related, but sometimes they're at a higher level, more at the conceptual or the logical design layer. That's something that I think is important. But I think there's another thing to think about, because you and I talked about this previously on how do you, when we look at an architect, do their skills expire or do they just evolve over time? Because I think with the certifications that we have, that methodology doesn't really change, but now we have to start thinking about other things that are coming into play. Things like AI, generative AI, use of large language models, some of the ransomware stuff, things like that. These all come into play, and it'd be very beneficial for anyone who's an architect or going down that path to make sure that they're aware of some of the bleeding edge technologies, not just the current or cutting edge. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
It
does.
Be prepared for what the future holds, and our jobs will evolve. There might be slightly different approaches. Right now, I think most companies are advising individuals, because of the risk of plagiarism, the risk of IP corruption, we don't want to use generative AI to create our own software products and stuff like that, but they can be used as part of research and so on. But I think we're going to see a lot more on that, and there's a few talks that are coming up for the Explore event. I've got one on that area with Chris Gulley, another person that I've been working with the last couple of years on presentations around the evolution of cloud.
Oh, and fantastic. I think that's going to be an interesting one.
We'll touch a little bit on some of the considerations on architecture, but a lot of it is more on regulatory compliance or avoiding the risk that generative AI can give you by taking all this data from all kinds of sources, vetted and unvetted, valid and potentially speculation. And how do we actually use that going forward?
Actually, that brings up a really good point. So the role of the architect might evolve and change a little bit, but I feel that anytime we have a tool as an architect that we use, we need to still be able to manually validate that that data is correct. So that the example I always give people is with sizing an environment. So there's plenty of tools out there to size for vSAN or Nutanix or whatever you want to size.
Yep.
But if you don't know how to manually validate that sizing to a reasonable level of confidence, then you shouldn't be using that tool, because these tools make mistakes. They're written by humans. Yep. We all make mistakes. And you might have accidentally just simply hit the wrong number. You might have hit a 2 instead of a 1, and the solution could be twice the size, or it could be half the size, which would be even worse because it wouldn't function. So I think that's one key detail, is no matter what tool we have, no matter what AI brings, we still need to have that capability as architects and as engineers to be able to validate and test things manually. Because otherwise these tools may or may not work, and we only find out when it's too late.
Yep, absolutely.
That was just a key point I thought I would bring up, and sizing is one of my pet topics. So,
yep.
So the value of the VCDX, getting back onto this program we've both invested so much time and effort into.
Yeah.
How have you seen that help your career? So you've been VCDX now
a couple of things. One, and I forget the exact timing, but it was one of the things that helped lead me to become a principal because of that work plus other stuff that I'd done. But it also opened the door for moving into a CTO role when I moved to EMC, then Dell and VirtuStream. Got to work on patents, worked on some more books, but also got to work on a lot of strategy around use of data, the early stages of large language models. I mean, these are the things that I think for each of us, as we develop our career, also make sure that your if your career doesn't always align with your interest areas. Let's say, like me, I'm very interested in AI. I'm interested in certain other things tied to security. And that's something that I've been trying to do as part of my research and some of my talks at conferences. But as we go forward, it's important that we all continue to develop and grow in the role that we have, whether it's learning new technology, learning new approaches, learning some new methodologies that can be adopted for success. That's all going to be key. And, you know, the other thing is a lot of the stuff that we've learned going through the architecture process also applies with what we do in real life. So, for example, if you have a house or certain other projects, you get some of those methodologies that you start saying, oh, you know, this bleeds through. And we actually use some of that as part of a day-to-day and vice versa, stuff that we learn in the real life. How do we come back? I mean, the one funny story from the first book on the stories from the field was around individuals where the architect kind of felt like a kindergarten teacher. They're herding cats and, you know, trying to make sure that, hey, you really need to get something done, or you need somebody in this role that has the right skill set. I mean, these are all the things that an architect has to think about. There's the people, process, and then, of course, the technology areas.
Yeah, I think the people is the most difficult piece because everyone has an opinion, everyone has experiences. A lot of the time, the experiences are different. I think the technology piece is more predictable and easier, but obviously people is critically important. You want to engage with people and mentor and things like that.
And one other thing that I will add is once I got the VCGX, and I've heard this from almost every other VCGX that has been asked to have a meeting with an executive at a company, having the VCGX has opened the door. Same thing with NPX, same thing with, you know, CCIE and other high-level certifications. Typically, the executives will talk to the salesperson or somebody who's talking strategy. They tend not to talk to technology specialists. I don't know if that's right or wrong.
I agree.
It depends
that's
on the company
true,
and the individual. But I do think it's important that having that cred at the higher level helps open the door and be able to engage and get meetings with some of those people that might have been more difficult in the past. It's like if I were to approach you, let's just say I was job hunting and I was approaching you and I had a high school degree, a college degree, or a postgraduate degree, like master's or PhD. You're going to have different opinions before you actually even see my resume based on that just little bit of information. I think this helps confirm that, you know, the person that that you're going to be talking to understands you have both the strategic and the tactical background and can talk at their level as well.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. That's been my experience. And also, you know, that's why my team is all VCDXs. So I'm lucky to have a team of four VCDXs because it does open the door. They have the experience to help customers have a strategic discussion, solve real world problems. And they're not just technical experts. They actually operate at the business level as well. So for sure, that certification gets you in the door sometimes, and often when you're introduced, you know, you'd be VCDX number one. So hey, this is the first VMware certified design expert in the world.
It makes it a little easier with the number one, but
yeah, the number one's pretty cool. So,
but just the number is not as important as the letters that are in front that demonstrates absolutely. That skill level.
Yeah, the number's just a bit of fun, but obviously the letters are important. Yeah.
By the way, there's one other thing, too, that we've talked about in the past, and this has been discussed online. How many times should somebody take an architect-level certification? And I know there are people who said, oh, if I have to take it more than once or twice, it's not worth it. I do know one person. I'm not going to name names, and I think there's more than one. But this one individual basically made the decision to pay for everything themselves because they didn't get support from management. And it did take a couple of tries, but they did get it. Once they got that, they moved on. They got a higher compensation. They got a position with better respect. And I'm not saying people should just leave their jobs, but I'm saying the person felt that they were stuck, you know, maybe where they were. They weren't getting the support for the advanced skills. They took it on themselves. They managed their career. They took the reins and ran with it. And once they got that, that really made the difference for them. I didn't move between companies because I got the VCGX. I used it to do my work and continue on the stuff I was doing at VMware. But later on, when I chose to kind of make a move around to other companies, that really did help on getting to the right people, talking to the right people, and having some pre-qualifications completed before I actually got to the interview process. So I think that's another benefit of getting any of these higher level certs, including the architect level.
Yeah, I would imagine the person who's attempted multiple times got great experience throughout that process. So I can only say that, you know, I think sitting it multiple times, if you happen to fail, doesn't matter. You're not named and shamed or anything. There's no consequence if you fail. All you've done is...
I have all the respect in the world. There is no shame at all. Nobody should be embarrassed. He was dedicated. I'm taking charge of my career. I'm getting this done, whether or not
I think that's kudos more than anything else, is knowing what you want and going after it.
Yeah.
And even if we have setbacks in life, going after it is something I really respect. So I know multiple people who actually attempted. I mentored a few people through the program, and some people attempted the exam too early, in my opinion. And realistically, they failed just due to the fact they didn't have time to prepare. But what I saw in those people who attempted multiple times is they went up in leaps and bounds every time.
Yes.
So if anything, I would say failing once, twice, three, 10 times is only going to make you better. So if anything, passing on the first go is kind of limiting your ability to continue learning, because you might get to there and go, oh, well, I'm certified. I'm at the level. But I think continuing to challenge yourself is really important. And, you know, when VMware released the VCDX for cloud, that was one of the reasons I submitted for the second VCDX, because I wanted to, you know, that was maybe 2 years after I got my data center virtualization VCDX. I wanted to challenge myself again. And 2 years later, roughly, that was when NPX became a thing, and I wanted to challenge myself again. So I think whether I'd passed or failed and attempted three times, you know, I would still be where I am today. I should probably be better if I failed. If anything, because I would have challenged myself further to get better. And, you know, I mean, I know roughly what the scoring rubrics would look like. So, you know, maybe I would have got a better score. Maybe I'd just scraped through. And now maybe I would pass with flying colors. Who knows? But so I think, attempting the certification
nothing like
is great.
There's nothing like learning under pressure the things that you don't yet have in your head, and going back and getting it, because it's a little different than doing a practice exam, doing the real one. Yeah. But the thing on the certification side, it is a high cost because of the number of people that have to be present. But for the ones where you're going into a testing center, those don't have the same high level. You may need to take some courses or do some of your own studying, but anyways, that's
I've always been a fan of certifications, even though, you know, I don't necessarily think the lower level exams have a huge amount of value. They are a way to validate that you know certain things, and they get you to the next step. And I'm a big fan of the VCAP level exams, VCIX level exams that are either practical or reasonably practical in the design exam case. So yeah, I recommend everyone goes through that process, because for sure I'm not where I am in life today without going through VCDX. Can't recommend it enough. All right, so we touched on the horror stories. Do you want to give a quick plug to the books, because I think these are things people should read, even, you know, the one I contributed to a couple of years ago, but also the latest one I think you did with Steve Kaplan.
So there's a I kind of lost count, but I think there's like 10 books out that I've worked on. But the Stories from the Field, Volumes 1 and 2. One came out about 2 years ago. I was actually in the middle of – actually, it's almost 3 years now. But I was in the middle of the fires in California. We were evacuated. I had to quit the startup job and focus on the family. I always make this recommendation. Health and family should always come first, no matter what. But that's what I chose to do, and I figured while I'm – in evacuation mode, staying at somebody else's house. I worked on getting that book out. I didn't add a story on that one, but the thing is, that first book, thank you for contributing on it. We got a lot of other VCDX, NPX, and other people with different skills in architecture, admin, project management, and so on, which was great. There was another thing on top of that that I thought was really interesting is a good friend of mine, and I've known him through a Kickstarter project going back to around 2010. His name's Johannes. He's the artist who's done work on over 300 bands cover work. That first book that, you know, that we did, the Stories from the Field, that cover was seen by Alan Parsons of the Alan Parsons Project, who also, and he also worked on Dark Side of the Moon for Pink Floyd and so on. He saw that and he said, you know what? I really like this. Can you do a modified version of this for my album cover? And this was last year. And the album was called Brave New World. And then I just found the new book, which I just sent over to you. You should get that in within the next week or so.
Thank you.
But it was picked up by Styx. So I'm like, you know, it's kind of interesting that there's some things outside of the core work that you're doing, the technology piece, that you start getting associated with or connected with because of one thing, like a book or working at a particular customer. You might meet somebody who introduces you to somebody else that's well known. And that's how, like in the tech industry, meeting people like Brian Kernahan and Dennis Ritchie, you know, from the C days, you know, to Linus, you know, and other types of people in the Unix space. I think those are all great little side effects of being able to work at these advanced levels, because then you start presenting at more conferences, or actually if you don't, my recommendation would be, because that actually helps to further develop not only your skills because of the questions you get, but it helps develop your brand. And absolutely, the brand is very important from a career standpoint.
Yeah, presenting has been great. So, I mean, probably maybe 2010, roughly, I started presenting at VMUGs and the V Forums, I think they used to be called, and things like this. And it was fantastic because, again, that was challenging me to come up with a topic that I thought was interesting, create some content, rehearse and share that and make sure I was knowledgeable in the area. And then when people come up after the sessions, they want to know more and, oh, who are you and where do you work? And, oh, you know, but they fanboy almost a little bit on you, which is very humbling. But you actually meet some really cool people, because those people who come up and ask you questions are the passionate people in our community that we can all learn from and become friends with. So, yeah, I've found the social media and the presenting and, you know, going to these events has been great, just on a personal level, meeting so many talented people. And when you join a startup, it's great to have a network like that, because you can bring in all these amazing talent that that you've met over the years.
There's one other thing too, and I'm not going to say this is true in every situation, but having those advanced degrees gives you the ability to also talk at some conferences on areas that go above and beyond what the conference is about. As an example, I mentioned I'm doing the Future State Architecture presentation at the upcoming VMware Explore conference, but I have three other sessions I'm doing with other co-speakers. One architecture and re-architecture related to AI in, you know, for workloads and for the infrastructure, generative AI and large language models that a lot of companies, including VMware, are now looking at. We're looking at how we need to be careful about plagiarism, about loss of IP, potential risk of that. But we're also going to give one other talk that I'm doing with Tony Foster, aka Wonder Nerd from Dell, who I know you know. He and I are going to be giving a talk on the state of quantum computing today.
Yeah, fantastic.
And where it's going. And I think we may be the only ones talking about that, but this is an area that I try to push the bar on what I can cover that's related to my interest areas. This is more on my principal side. That's more tied to the CTO's office. Mm-hmm. But it's also related to some of the customers I work with that are starting to use AI and are starting to consider large language models and generative AI in their design of their infrastructure and the choice of some of the technology solutions there, as well as those challenges with generative AI and large language models that are created or using data from other sources besides the company you work at.
Yeah, absolutely. Security, validation, IP, all that's critical. So that'll be a very interesting talk. I'll see if I can get to that one. Explore is going to be good fun. It's my first Explore for a few years, so that'll be great.
Well, we'll definitely plan on hanging out and getting caught up.
We definitely will, for sure. I actually wanted to touch on the horror story that I put in that first book.
Yeah.
Because I think this really summarizes well the value of an architect. So, you know, this customer many years ago had two data centers. They had an environment. I won't even name the vendor, but they had, you know, this vendor's technology at both sites, and they were doing replication between the sites. Now, whomever designed this, I don't know who it was, but whoever designed it didn't consider that that replication wasn't really a backup. It was simply a highly available, you know, fast recovery copy, and it was based on snapshot technologies. And effectively what happened was the first issue was the environment slowed down over time. So day one, everything seemed great. You know, month two, everything was great. But after 6 or 12 months, it started to slow down. And it started to slow down to the point where it was creating an impact. So the first issue was a performance issue. And then basically what happened over time was they realized they couldn't keep that much data because of capacity limits. So then it became capacity, then it became performance. And then the mitigation for that was, you know, additional hardware and software, and that became not viable from a cost perspective. So we were really getting to a bad point. And then they actually started having outages. And it's at this point is where, you know, I got called in. And unfortunately, I had to give the bad news, which was this was a conceptual design issue. This wasn't a tweak of a setting or a change we could quickly resolve the issue. This really was a redesign. And unfortunately, that was going to be costly for all involved. The partner, the vendor, obviously the customer was suffering, you know, quite dramatically. So as much as I was able to mitigate some of those issues in the short term, those mitigations all came with risks and compromises to the amount of data that was being stored, the frequency of the copies. And that's just a great example of why you need to map business to technical. And you need that deep technical understanding that, yes, products can do snapshots and copies and replication, but there's always going to be a limit. And some vendors will say there's no limit and all this kind of stuff. Every product has limits. So you need to understand those limits before you implement and while you're doing the design. And you also need to have a mitigation that in the event you are coming close to these limits, how are you going to work around them? Whether it's a scalability discussion or whether it's a migration or whatever the resolution will be. So this customer really suffered from simply not having an architect do the conceptual design and then validate the physical design against that conceptual. And there was a bit of a technical product knowledge gap, I think, as well. But overall, that methodology that we always talk about for VCDX and NPX helps us mitigate and avoid these situations. So I think that's what, in that situation, it was just a simple case of, you know, you would think at a high level, you have two data centers, you have multiple copies of your data at two data centers, you're in a pretty good spot, which you are, but only for certain scenarios. That doesn't protect you against, like ransomware, for example. Had they got hit with ransomware with that setup, even if it wasn't a scalability or performance issue, then their whole environment would have been compromised. And then it would have been, how do we recover? More than likely, they would have had just catastrophic data loss and not been able to recover without paying a ransom or if at all. So, yeah, that was a very quick summary of my story for that book. And, I hope people, you know, take those lessons in that book, because there's a number of very good lessons. And when they go through their design process, think about those topics and mitigate those risks, because I certainly don't want to see volume 10, 12, 13 of that book, because that would, that would mean
we
people
only
are not
three
learning the lesson.
We only planned three, and we wanted to make sure there's a sufficient amount for each one as we went forward. So I think the next one is, I don't know if we'll release it next year or the year after, but I want to focus now on a new release of the VCDX Bootcamp book.
Yes.
Because I keep getting asked a question. Unfortunately, Pearson has not been responsive, but I did reach out to Mustafa Khalil, who said he's going to rejoin for doing that second.
Oh,
it
fantastic.
Might be an updated version or, you know, an addendum, so to speak.
Well, if you want
to
hand,
other
I'm happy
one.
To jump in, because I would love to grow that VCDX program. The boot camps are critical. You know, Carl Childs is the VCDX program manager, for anyone who doesn't know. And, you know, I think Carl is very dedicated to growing the program. And for anyone listening at VMware, please throw your support behind the program, because it'll just deliver great technologists, great architects, and even more important, great outcomes for customers. So I think the more support behind it, and the quicker we can grow from that 300 VCDX number to like 1,000, the better, I think, because being even 300 globally is a tiny number. And
yeah, the original plan was we would have been over 500 by now, but things just happen and how things go. And one of the things that we did do early on was create a fast track. It's like a 5-day workshop. Where people come in with designs. We have several other VCGXs in there, and we go through the whole process of evaluating designs, looking through the methodology and all of that. That's only been offered once, and I'm kind of hoping that it might be something that can be offered again, but it might be tied to the number of people and the cost of kind of trying to manage putting some of that together. But it's something that might be able to be covered in this updated VCDX bootcamp book. It'll probably have a different name, but I mean, yeah, the idea is let's make sure that we cover all of the certifications, but I think we also could benefit from having an addendum or some part of it that also talks about some of the other certifications like NPX and so on, and how, you know, there's a commonality on how these are being put together versus how things used to be done in the past for architecture certifications.
Absolutely. And look, the value of those boot camps, I didn't participate in the one you mentioned, but for Nutanix, we created a boot camp series for enterprise architecture. We also did a boot camp series for business critical apps, because both of those areas, there's huge gaps in the market, even today, for skill set. And what we did was it ranged between a 3- and 5-day boot camp, very intensive, in person. Multiple NPX, VCDX level instructors. And we ran people through a design sizing exercise. Day one, it was just, hey, do some sizing for us. Let's see what you come up with. From there, we would analyze, you know, their capabilities. We'd put them into groups to make sure the skill sets were aligned. Then we would give them a new challenge. We would say, oh, can you add this to your design? And then I would give them an example of how I would size and how quickly it can be done to a reasonable level if you follow a process and you know that methodology. And then over that boot camp, we would then change requirements. We would insert, you know, fake requirements and problems and things that wouldn't work. And what that boot camp showed me was how valuable it is to go through that process, because a lot of the candidates were well-known, well-respected people, but that boot camp was able to identify the gaps in their skill set, which meant we were able to fix those holes. None of us are perfect. We all have gaps. So as far as I'm concerned, if you can tell me where my gaps are, that's incredibly valuable just on its own, just that piece of information. Knowing my weakness, you know, is fantastic, because then I can actively address those weaknesses. And what we saw was the candidate day one versus day three or day five were worlds apart in their capability. It was like we were able to give them years of experience uplift within just a couple of days because of how that program was structured. So, I'd be happy to be involved if VMware wanted to do one of those again in creating that content, delivering and things like that, because it's great to see people go from, you know, wherever they are now, whatever their skill level is, to a much higher level. It's very rewarding to help with those programs.
Yeah. I will let Carl know. We'll definitely sync after this for some more on that.
But definitely. So anyone out there who, if you ever hear about a boot camp, whether it's a VMware or Nutanix or whoever, it doesn't matter, attend that boot camp. That's really valuable. And have a go. Speak up. Don't be afraid to, you know, try and say the wrong answer, or no one's going to laugh at you. And, you know, I think the people who got the most out of those boot camps were the ones who took a risk, right? They stood up in front of the group, they presented something, you know, they, you know, put their heart on their sleeve or whatever the old saying is, and they just had a go. Yeah. And, you know, we all get better from trying.
By the way, one thing too, that I'll point out, The concept of boot camp seemed very innocent when we first came up with that term. But then people said, hey, but this is tied to military or whatever. So regardless, I think what they've done is they've changed it to workshops to avoid that potential challenge. Yes. So just so that everyone's aware, the term boot camp had nothing to do, you know, anyways, it was just a term that we ended up using
because involved,
we felt it was a quick way. So it's just, you know, it's how it is. You pick a name and then anyways. But yeah, I think these workshops are
very good. There's nothing to be intimidated about. If someone in the boot camp, if an instructor is asking a question of a candidate, it's with good thought behind it. It's to invoke a response. It's to try and challenge that person to go from the level they're at to that next level. So I always think about when I'm trying to mentor someone, I try and categorize them as in a certain skill area. Are they at the 101, the 201, the 301, or are they really at the expert 401 level? So if a candidate is giving me an answer that I think has covered off the 101 really well, I will ask them a deeper question at the 201 level. And if they can answer that, I will go deeper again to the 301 and then the 401. And I think that's really helpful, and I personally quite like that because I eventually get to the point where I don't know something and I go, I'm going to investigate that. I've had a couple of candidates who found that a bit intimidating, and I can say with all sincerity that that was never my intention to make someone feel uncomfortable. So if you're in a boot camp and an instructor is asking you questions, this is almost a compliment to you. This is you have achieved a certain level and they are trying to challenge you to jump to the next level. It's by no means anything negative. And to your point about the name boot camp, maybe people took it the wrong way.
It's not just what the candidate provides. It's how they respond to the questions that helps with maximum scoring. And that's to make sure that, hey, you know, there's a rubric that's not published for any of these architects. There's a blueprint, but you don't publish the rubric because it may have stuff that could actually unfairly help somebody.
Absolutely.
But the goal is to make sure that you know the details, and if we need clarification, maybe there's a misunderstanding, maybe the test, you know, we're doing the exams or the defenses in English, but let's say somebody that's not their first language and there may be a misunderstanding, and that happens. It has happened. The clarification makes all the difference. In some cases, there have been situations in the past, and I don't know if this is still happening, where we had to actually pause temporarily the timer because of a language barrier. I think it's gotten better. We try to make sure that there's somebody who has, I guess I'll say, some ability to communicate with the candidate. But, you know, I'm not doing the panels right now because I'm just so swamped with my current job. I haven't been able to volunteer to do that. So I'm trying to help in the other ways, you know, around that. But I do plan on getting my cloud certification also. I'm just a little bit behind because I'm just so swamped in all the other stuff I'm working on.
These programs are a lot of work, and they are volunteer. NPX was all volunteer as well. And, you know, it is difficult to find the time, but I think it's worth it both as a candidate and as a person contributing to the program. So whichever side of the fence you fall on, for the listeners out there, go for it, please. So we've talked about just going through our list. We had a lot to cover, and I think we've done a good job so far. So we've talked about the VCDX and what it is and the value in your experience. We've talked about becoming an architect. You mentioned going to conferences and going to sessions and seeing what's on the bleeding edge and trying to focus on that. I think that's a really key point. We've also talked about the boot camps and what happens if you fail the certification. Of course, you just get better. Failing is not really failing. I think the old saying is the only failure is failure to try, which I think is very true in this case. So that's really good. And we've talked about the books that obviously you've led and I've contributed to as well. And you've talked about your story as well. The one thing that we skipped over, though, was I had a note that we wanted to talk about the VCDX being somewhat like an insurance policy. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so, you know, as we go through and we are putting together a design, What we're trying to do is ensure that a customer does not run into an issue because of a flaw in the design or a flaw in the requirements or the constraints that are provided to the architect. That involves discussion, covering, you know, the request. I can give an example. One customer wanted to do use a metropolitan optical network that was 1 gigabit, and the distance between the two sites was 26 miles. Maybe you can help me on converting to kilometers. My
apologies. About 40 kilometers. Yeah.
About 40. Yep. Yep. And so it exceeded some limitations related to some of the technology they wanted to use. So they wanted to do vMotion over that network, do the management network there, do the workloads there, and they also wanted to use DRS to shift workloads between the two sites. And that added a lot of complexity. I don't want to go into all the details because there's many in there, but number one, there's a limit on vMotion, and there's certain other requirements that talk about an infrastructure, whether it's VMware or other companies, on what is the minimal amount and when you should segment either on, you know, the bare wire bandwidth or through VLANs or other technology to ensure you get the performance. Well, I looked at this and I said, this is not something that should be done, because they also had mainframe workloads going across that wire. If they were at one location where the VM also had its local storage and now DRS moved it to the alternate location, now a request starts at one location, it goes over to the other site for the compute to respond, which then comes back to the first site to get the data, then goes back to that second site to process the data, and then it goes back to the first site again to respond. So think about the delays in that time frame. So I knew this was going to be a problem. So in the documentation, because I could not convince them to change this approach, I said, it will fail, guaranteed. Here is what to do to see where, when you're starting to approach that, and what to do. I had already given them the directions on what to do. Segment out the one set of traffic, the VMware environment, and the subsections, vMotion and the other stuff, from all the other traffic. And that would probably require another metropolitan optical network. I'm sure there's a cost to that. Well, anyways, within about a month or so is when they started noticing performance issues. And it didn't come from the side of the virtual machines as much as the other workloads.
Yeah.
Whether it was mainframe or other things, just because of the way that non-virtualized environments treat resources versus a software-defined environment. And so in that particular case, they hit the limits, they saw where the problem was, and eventually they actually changed their approach and they separated out the virtual environments infrastructure and, in particular, the vMotion traffic, so that they wouldn't run into any issues on that part of the infrastructure side. So it's just something that we have to work through and figure out. But when there's a problem that you can't change, I do want to warn people that if you don't include that in your design, you know, that, hey, here's the red flag, and I actually put it in red text so that it would be obvious, then you're going to get stung later on saying, well, why didn't you fight for this harder? If it was this serious, why didn't you shut the project down until we got this resolved and things like that? There's only so much you can do in the time frame that you get on a project and the individuals you work with to kind of go through that process. Having to do this over again, I may be forced to do it the same approach, but I prefer not to say, I know there's going to be a problem, and here's what to do when that happens. I would rather say, don't do this. Do it this way. It'll cost more, or whatever the reason is, because it'll eliminate those problems later on that could cost way more than the cost of the actual technology you had.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that I made the decision, you know, many years ago to do in my career was not be afraid to say no. And I learned this from Sadish, who was the president at Nutanix, actually. So, you know, his concept was, if it wasn't the best thing for the customer, we need to walk away. We can't allow the customer to use technology or software or whatever the solution is where it's going to put them in a bad position.
Yeah.
So, you know, during the last like 10 years, I've been very comfortable just educating the customer on what I think the problem is, what the risk is, what the mitigations are, but also at certain points, just saying no. I'm not willing to help you on this project because I believe it'll be putting you in a dangerous position, and this is not where I want you to go. And then educating them on where we would be able to go, what their options are. But, you know, in extreme situations, I think saying no is the only way to go. And obviously in the other situations, it's absolutely warn them about the risk and mitigate everything possible and educate them, as you did in this case, on if something goes wrong, here are the likely things that will go wrong, and here's what you need to do to investigate and potentially resolve those problems when they occur.
And everything you just covered ensures customer success, because you want to ensure that they get the product and it doesn't become shelfware because of they run into something that could have been addressed earlier on and avoid that particular problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that comes back to the topic of, you know, having a VCDX do your design is like an insurance policy, because it's making sure that you're mitigating risks. And if something does go wrong, there's going to be an option, even if it's not necessarily a great option, there is going to be an option for you to, you know, recover from that situation.
Yeah. And if you don't address that issue, I don't think I covered this earlier, but if you don't address that issue, you may not get payout by the insurance company. It could be less, or they may say, look, you don't have any backups because they were all stolen or something like that, and they stole all your equipment. That happened with a customer before I even got started in the virtualization space. Somebody backed a truck up through the front doors of a startup, and there was a customer I was working with, and they stole all the hardware and all the backup tapes. And the insurance company said, well, how are you going to recover your business if you've lost everything? And one of the people at the company, one of the executives, had a copy of some backup tapes from a few weeks earlier, and that was what made the difference on full payout versus no payout. You know, I don't remember any more than that, but that was such a memorable event, because it's very rare that I've had I think this was the only case where a customer told me somebody backed a pickup through their front windows and stole and all stole their equipment.
IP. Yeah, that's so, I mean, it's not
funny, but it's humorous in a way, because it just seems trivial looking back on it now that it could have been solved very easily. But, you know, in a startup mode, sometimes there's many things going on and you miss something important like that. And that's,
yeah, and it you is want important. To make sure that you can get paid out on the insurance. Important. I remember that one of the first times I ever went into a data center, there was a cage around these racks, and, you know, there was a security guard and you had to get a key and all this kind of stuff to get into this cage that held racks within this secure data center. And I remember laughing at the time. I was inexperienced and, you know, well before my VCDX. And I thought, who's going to steal anything physically in a data center? Like, there's a lock on the door. Like, you can't just get in here easily. But sure enough, it does happen. And the cost of a cage around a rack is pretty trivial compared to the cost of an outage. So I think that's, again, the value of a good architect is able to talk to the business impact and cost of not doing something, such as security or things like that. And making sure something is secure is very important at the physical layer, not just the application layer. So John, let's wrap up. I think we've had a great discussion. I really enjoyed it. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with us?
My thought is, pick your career, and if you're looking at the architect, make sure that you're doing the due diligence on learning about the different aspects, not just the technology piece of creating the design, but also ensuring success when you're working with challenging situations. You know what I mean? Where requirements might have some conflicts, performance versus network bandwidth. Maybe that has something to do with it. I mean, things like that. My suggestion, though, is most architects will be willing to take on a mentee as a mentor. And I've done that. And I think you've done that also, Josh. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is these types of boot camps and workshops where they train about architecture design are valuable for everyone, especially when you can do what's called a mock defense, meaning it's not a real defense, but you have people that are going to ask you those critical questions, the good, the bad, and the ugly about your design and how you respond, what you might do different. And remember, you may submit a design that maybe when you're in the testing situation, you recognize, or maybe just before you went in there, that, hey, you would have done something different in the design. You can definitely talk about that. And that's something that they look for. Oh, this design was done 6 months ago. the customer had it. But now 6 months later, we learned that if we change these areas, it would have been a better customer experience, maybe less problems, better performance or functionality and things like that. But take control of your career. Make sure that you understand, you know, the supporting evidence behind your design decisions, and look for a mentor and take advantage of some of these offerings on workshops or boot camps.
Oh, the mock panel is a topic we should have covered earlier, but absolutely. Mock panels are fantastic. I was very lucky. Yeah. One of my team members at End2End, James Worth, he and I actually did our VCDXs together. We did our VCP, our VCAPs, all the study we actually did together. I remember sitting on his kitchen table doing that. So also, not only get a mentor to assist, but get a study buddy. Get someone who wants to go through the same process and help each other out. I know James was incredibly valuable to me. I hope I was valuable to him as well. But that process with a study buddy was much easier to go through, I think, much more enjoyable. And also, the mock panels we gave each other, because this was the early days. There wasn't really a lot of people to help, but we mock paneled each other and even got friends and colleagues who weren't at that level simply to ask us dumb questions. And that allowed us to think on our feet and practice the presentation side. And in the end, they weren't actually dumb questions. They were just questions that maybe the panel wouldn't ask, but they were questions that a customer might have asked or something like that. So it doesn't matter who does the mock panel. It just matters if people ask you.
There's something that I'll share with you that you can include, you know, as part of the blog post. And that is there's a series of three videos that I did with Mustafa Khalil, Ben Lin, and Rawlinson Rivera. Rawlinson, and I think Melissa Tweet was there at the time. So it's going back about 10 years. So it's a while, but it's still relevant. And it goes through the three phases of what used to be the VCDX panel defense. Mm-hmm. Now it's only two phases. There is the present your design. Mm-hmm. There is troubleshooting in an environment. And then there is looking at troubleshooting. Yeah, exactly. A design exercise itself. So the two exercises on the implemented design and creating a design are designed to actually test out your thought process. And having a talk through as you go through that is very valuable. But these recordings we did, although they're older, they went into the details of what to do and what not to do. And there is a fourth video that has outtakes if you want to have some fun stuff. But Rawlinson's a great guy in presenting and going through this. He presented and he definitely emphasized on some of the mistakes that people made that I think you'll find both educating and humorous as well. So I'll share that with you. I don't have it offhand
right now.
I actually
recall I've seen those in the past after I did my VCDX, actually, which was terrible because I would have benefited significantly had I seen it before.
Yeah.
But I would love to share those and get those out if that's okay. That would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, I can find it and share with you after we're done with this call. So, but I think that'll be beneficial. I also would reference other architecture documents that are out there. For me, Zachman was the first person who I kind of learned a little bit about the concept of conceptual, logical, physical. Mm-hmm. And that's where he wrote about conceptual, logical, physical. It is simple. And he gave the story of a house. I'm not going to go into the details because I cover them in other videos as well, but it's definitely something to think about. People can take a look for that story by Zachman, and it's a great way to look at those three phases of design for those that are getting up to speed on architecture and on design.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I think that's a
great
place to
end. I definitely want to thank you so much for having me on for this, and definitely looking forward to seeing you at the VMware Explore event. So
it's been my pleasure, John. I appreciate it. It's great to have someone of your experience and talent on, and I can't wait to see you at Explore.
Cool. Sounds good.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you. Cool. Cheers.